Aaron Swartz is one of those names we come to know after the person is gone. Swartz was a programmer, a hacker, and a kind of freedom of information activist. Before he turned 20, he'd made a fortune for his work on the website Reddit. He later worked on the successful campaign against the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, that was making its way through Congress in 2012.
So yeah, maybe sometimes you feel like you're not being listened to, but I'm here to tell you that you are. You are being listened to. You are making a difference. You can stop this bill if you don't stop fighting.
That was Swartz speaking at a protest in New York in January 2012. Just a year later, when he was 26 years old, Swartz hanged himself in his apartment. At the time, he'd been fighting an aggressive federal prosecution, charges of wire and computer fraud, and possibly years in federal prison, all for illegally downloading millions of pages of academic articles. That case and Swartz's life are the subjects of a new documentary called The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz. Brian Knappenberger directed the film. It tells the story of a young man who was hounded by government investigators, but it does less to explain the other reasons why he might have taken his own life. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this case a little bit. It started late 2010, early 2011, when he gets a laptop. He's working at Harvard, and he uses this laptop. He actually takes it next door to MIT, puts it in a closet, hardwires it to MIT's system in order to download millions of documents from this paid database called JSTOR. This is one of these companies that archives academic journals. If you're a student, you can access them for free, but anybody else has to pay for them. So he starts downloading millions of these articles.
Right. Actually, the closet and the connection directly to the server was the last of a cat and mouse game that he was playing with the MIT tech folks trying to kick him off their network. So what he does is he goes on the MIT network, which is sort of famously fast and famously open. And from there, he has direct access to the JSTOR database, and he starts downloading these articles, then evades several attempts to kind of kick him off the network. And then he ends up in this closet where he's found out by authorities, first MIT, then I think Cambridge Police, and then this escalates to the Secret Service. They don't stop the downloads. They let it keep going, and they insert surveillance cameras in this small closet in the basement of MIT building.
And one of the most amazing things about the film is that we see this footage.
Yeah, you see him enter this closet and start to change the hard drives. And one of these times, after they catch him on camera, they chase him down in the streets of Cambridge, arrest him, and put him in solitary confinement.
And one of the key issues for federal prosecutors ultimately was the question of why he was doing this.
Yes.
Why was he downloading this material? Because I think that's what you're going to build the case on. Was there criminal intent? He never really answered that question, but what do you think the answer
exactly
is?
Exactly right. We don't know. He was arrested before he did anything with the article, so we are left to speculate a little bit. So there's really only three choices. One is that he would have tried to sell them. That seems silly to almost anybody looking at this case, that he would have tried to profit somehow off of this. The second thing is that he may have just been wanting to dump them online. You know, he may have just wanted to kind of liberate this. And this is consistent with lots of things that he said throughout his life, the kind of heart of this kind of open access movement, which is sort of deeply offended that this taxpayer-funded research would be behind a paywall. But the third version started becoming increasingly more likely to me as I was making the documentary, and it's speculated that what he might have been doing is downloading these articles to analyze them for corporate funding, corruption, essentially, that led to biased results in research, particularly in the area of climate change.
So almost to be an investigative journalist with these
That's
documents
exactly right.
And try to sort of come up with a story from the documents. So knowing that was probably his motive, why did prosecutors go after him so hard,
well,
do you think?
I think there's a couple of...
And also, knowing that JSTOR ultimately dropped the case.
Yeah, the quote-unquote victim in the crime, JSTOR, just drops everything, and the feds march on as without skipping a beat.
Right.
You know, you have to look at a couple of things. Why did they go after him so hard? I think that one might have just been a mindset of like, well, there must be something going on here that he's profiting from. The prosecutor did tell Aaron's dad that they wanted to make an example out of him, that mm-hmm. they needed a case for deterrence. Mm-hmm. And it really makes you wonder, well, what were they deterring? Are there lots of people going around downloading articles from JSTOR? I mean, what kind of example were they trying to make? And I think this story becomes very dark when you start to ask those questions.
And that's when we really see the major turn in the story. I mean, it's late 2012. New indictments come down from the feds. Aaron refuses to take a final plea deal. A final trial date is set. And then in January 2013, he kills himself. He takes his own life. It happens kind of fast in the film. A few people kind of muse over whether or not he was depressed, but then it just kind of, and the film kind of moves on to something else. And as a viewer, I found myself wondering, oh, wait, I want to know if there's more to this. And, I went and read some articles and saw that he had written about suicide in the past. He had written about depression in the past. He had suffered from a really painful illness. I mean, why not include some of that in the film?
Well, we do, actually. And Taryn talks about him maybe having something like clinical depression in his early 20s.
Taryn was his girlfriend at the time of he died.
And they were living together as well, so she saw what he was going through. You know, she says that she didn't believe she had anything like that when she lived with him. His brother believed that that wasn't the case. I think a lot was made of that early on, and I didn't necessarily buy into it as much as some other takes on it were. He did do this after a 2-year legal nightmare that left him exhausted financially and emotionally, and he did commit suicide within a day or so of the 2-year anniversary of his initial arrest. That's not exactly a coincidence. Mm-hmm. It's hard to discount this hell that he was going through.
So in some ways, it's almost like the film is implying that the case is what killed him, what drove him to kill himself. I mean, is that what you want people to come away with?
I don't think it's that simple in the film. I would argue it's definitely not that simple in the film. He's a complex person. He certainly carried the world on his shoulders. At one point, somebody says he wasn't always comfortable with the world, and the world wasn't always comfortable with him. And I think that resonates through that film, too. A complex person, but to let the government off too easy on this, I think, is not quite right.
That's Brian Knappenberger. He's the director of the new documentary, The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz. It's in theaters and streaming online right now. Brian, thanks so much.
All right, thanks.
This year, the World Wide Web turns 25. Though it began as a tool for human communication, today, according to one study, more than 60% of the traffic on the web doesn't come from human beings. Web robots, good ones and bad ones, drive a lot of the activity online. And as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, all of those bots have some experts concerned about what's next on the web.
First, let's talk about the good bots. For example, Google's bots crawl around the web to find the best information, and there are bots that help make the web run smoothly.
Tools that check that out, websites are up and running all the time and measure how fast they are.
This is Mark Gaffin, the co-founder of Encapsula, a website security firm. His company released a report that found that bots are on the rise. In the 2 years ending in 2013, the percentage of non-human web traffic went up from around 50% to over 61% of all web traffic. And Gaffin says a little over half of those bots are bad.
Scanning your website, looking for vulnerabilities, they're potentially trying to hack into your website.
Once inside, bad bots can get a lot of information, corporate and government secrets. But Dan Kaminsky, the founder of the security firm White Ops, says they noticed that bots were going after individual users.
And they're not going after, you know, people with secret military documents. They're going after grandmothers. They're going after everyone they can. And we were genuinely curious. Why? Why hack grandma?
To take over grandma's identity, at least on the web. Kaminsky says there are underground companies that promise to bring viewers to your website to make the site more valuable to advertisers. The views look as if they're coming from grandma's computer.
They're doing a very little piece of identity theft. They're pretending to be you to advertisers who are willing to pay a little bit of money to get a little bit of your attention.
The problem with this kind of attention fraud, says Kaminsky, is that it lowers the quality of what's on the web.
You see the web sometimes, and you click a link, and you get a page, and there's 30 ads on it, and 5 of them are blaring audio at you, and you think, who could possibly ever find any value in this web page? And the answer is nobody. Nobody would ever go to a page like this, but nobody is. It's all machines tricking machines. Bots will click on anything. They have terrible taste.
Bots with bad taste will rule the web if left to their own devices. Today, the Pew Internet and American Life Project released a study in honor of the web's 25th anniversary. Pew interviewed 1,400 experts about their hopes and fears for the web's next decade. Lee Rainey is one of the study's authors.
That's what these experts worry about. If it becomes too overwhelming, there's too little trust, it's too hard to distinguish between human and machine interventions, that people will just shut down.
Yet at the same time, Rainey says many worry that people's attempts to protect themselves could also change the open nature of the web.
That they will shut down ways in which the internet can serve up diverse opinions, new things for them to learn, all sorts of extra things that would add to their life.
One thing that's certain, says Rainey, is that there will be a lot more bot traffic online in the future as more devices from medical monitors to home heating systems are connected to the internet. Rainey says in the future, we are likely to see a vast battle between good bots and bad bots. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
The Internet of Things. It's one of those phrases that once you hear it, it might stick in your head. And this is what you need to know. Soon, the majority of devices that connect to the internet will not be computers or smartphones, but the rest of the stuff we use in our lives. Fridges, light bulbs, door locks, bags of lettuce. Automatically changing temperature, checking for freshness, turning on or off, locking, unlocking, quietly running our homes. And gathering tons of information about how we live. So, are you creeped out? We're ready to let the robots take over. Let's ask Carlos Watson about this. He's the founder of the online magazine Ozzy, and he's joining me from his lookout in Mountain View, California. Hey, Carlos.
Hey, Kelly. How are you?
Good. This all sounds a little like, 3D sci-fi fantasy. How far away are we from this being real?
Well, if you've got a smartphone, which most of us do, it's not that far. And the fact that there are companies like Nest, the makers of those kind of cool smart thermostats, getting bought up for billions of dollars by companies like Google, and the fact that we're talking about things like Google Glasses or even the kind of so-called wearable computers like Fitbit or Nike Fuel means that after years of talking about it, it's here.
Okay, so it doesn't just apply to some of those things we're familiar with. What else? What other kind of devices are we talking about?
Well, the really interesting thing is that while we are talking about it a lot, Kelly, in terms of consumer-facing things, maybe even a bigger market for this, the true trillion-dollar market, may be when businesses try and run their own factories or offices better. So now they're saying, boy, we could manage things like how hot and cold a building is or how smartly our factory runs or even a hospital thinking about managing the beds and how warm the bed is for different patients. So that's even a bigger conversation that's starting to emerge.
I'm told there's even applications for prisons. What's that?
Indeed, one of our writers this week, Melissa Pandika, wrote about the epidemic in many cases of suicide in prisons, 2 to 3 times more suicides in prisons, much more mental illness. And in order to begin to deal with that in a very different way, a number of prisons have begun to use sensors that can sense early leading indicators of depression, whether that's a prisoner's breathing, the amount of movement. So you were seeing this idea, the Internet of Things, this idea that so many different things are connected to the internet that they can gather information and try and react smartly, as you're saying, show up in places you might not expect.
What about the creepy part of this, though? I mean, the privacy and security concerns about all the data that's being collected.
So totally freaking people out. It sounds a lot like Big Brother and 1984 and George Orwell. How much information do I really want someone to know about how often I sleep or about exactly when I show up at work or about how active I am when I'm working? And am I that comfortable with my boss or, frankly, in some cases, Facebook or Google knowing that information? The other piece that you're hearing a lot of concern about, security. How much am I at risk if someone hacks that information? Mm-hmm. If everything's connected to the internet, how vulnerable is not just your email, but health devices, your bank account, all sorts of other things?
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. He's based in Silicon Valley. Carlos, thanks so much.
Hey, really good to be with you. Have a great weekend.
We're spending part of our summer stargazing, and this week, as part of our series on looking at the heavens, we went to the U.S. Naval Observatory, which sits on high ground overlooking most of Washington. You're probably already familiar with what it does.
U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock. At the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 14 hours, 20 minutes exactly. Universal Time.
The Naval Observatory is the home of our national timekeeper, but it may be best known now as the official residence of the vice presidents. The observatory was completed in 1893, and basically it is still doing its original job, still looking at the stars.
This is the biggest telescope that we still have here in Washington, and I'm going to take you in there and show you how it works, because it's pretty cool. As far as we know, this is the oldest continuously operating telescope that is still used for gathering professional data in the world.
Our tour guide is Jeff Chester, who is himself an astronomer. He told us the telescope's original 1873 lens is still in place, but everything else is state-of-the-art 1890s. This handsome relic of the 19th century now teams up with powerful cameras and computers not dreamed of when it was built. It began by helping ships to navigate. Now it helps steer satellites. Jeff Chester took us inside the white dome, where the telescope towers high above, rising to point at its window, the slit in the dome. I can see the eyepiece for the telescope, but it's way up there.
Now, we do have ladders and that sort of thing, but that was a very, you know, that's so 19th century.
Oh, my goodness. The whole deck of the round floor of the dome is going up.
Indeed.
Like we're on an elevator entire floor?
We think this is the largest elevator in Washington.
Son of a gun. That was really scary when it started. Elevating the astronomer to the eyepiece is a bit of a parlor trick these days, since it is a camera that captures 30 frames a second that is really looking through the telescope at the stars. So what is the relationship between stargazing and timekeeping? At its most basic, for us Earthlings, we observe the rotation of our planet as it moves around the sun, our star, as a 24-hour day. We divide it into hours and into seconds. We relate time to events in our world. But really, Jeff Chester says, we invented time.
As far as we know, we are the only creatures that actually use time as a tool. And the other.
So what happens if you don't keep time?
With the technology that we have today, you would wind up back in the Stone Age, essentially.
Why would you go back to the Stone Age?
Well, think, for instance, about how dependent we're now on things like GPS, cell phones, computer networks, that kind of stuff. You make a phone call with your cell phone, and if there is no precise time synchronization, then all of the analog to digital conversion, the transmission of the digital data, the decoding of that transmitted data back into an analog signal that goes to the phone and the person at the other end that you're talking to, if you didn't have precise time, that wouldn't happen, period.
It is the evolution of technology, Chester says, that is driving the requirement for more precise time. And Chester took us to see the precision instruments which now measure time, the atomic clocks in their climate-controlled glass cells. These clocks are far beyond anything so basic as noticing when the sun rises or sets. Atomic clocks measure defined seconds. So what is a second?
Now, I always thought it was one Mississippi, but then I started working here.
Jeff Chester tells us atomic clocks count the oscillations of atoms bombarded by microwaves. You make a decision that so many billion oscillations of this little atom are going to be 1 second.
Correct. And that decision was made by a large committee of physicists.
Of course.
Back in 1967.
Uh-huh.
And since 1967, that has been what the definition of 1 second is.
I don't suppose you have that number by heart.
Oh, yes.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yes. So the second today is defined as the interval of 9,192,631,770 transitions of the hyperfine levels in the ground state of the cesium-133 atom.
Okay.
That's 1 second.
The observatory also uses the even more precise rubidium atom. And then, as they've always done, they consider a number of clocks and deliver a mean, and that's the time our digital devices, our satellites, and our weapon systems use. But they also deliver a time that anyone can use.
U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock at the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 11 hours, 13 minutes exactly.
So anyway, this is Fred Covington, and he passed away on July 28th of 1993. He recorded our original voice announcer back in the 1970s. I mean, you can see we have the little plaque up here that's dedicated to his memory. He's been serving us very well over the years.
But our guide, Jeff Chester, says we all use the much more precise and sophisticated measurements of time as well.
If you have a wireless router at your house, and just about everybody does these days, once a day, that will ping one of our NTP servers to get the correct time. And I always tell people, if you use a GPS, cell phone, or the internet, then the Naval Observatory is reaching out and touching you with its time.
Next in our stargazing series, DIY telescopes. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
There's hot competition among companies that put maps on the GPS device in your car or the screen of your smartphone. The industry rakes in tens of billions of dollars a year, according to the Boston Consulting Group. Reporter Christopher Wirth tells us about some of the players and how they do it.
When it comes to creating a digital map of the world, you may think of Google workers driving around in high-tech cars mounted with cameras, snapping photos of everything. But on a warm summer evening, Robert Scott walks the streets of London, jotting down address numbers with nothing more than a pen and a piece of paper.
15, and then this is number 11.
Scott is with OpenStreetMap, a British nonprofit that's built a digital map of the world over the past decade with the help of volunteers like himself and thousands of others around the globe. And every month or so, a few of them get together for mapping parties to collect data that's later added on a computer back home.
We've sometimes had strange looks when we're doing things like this.
Well, that's 8.
It hardly sounds like competition for Google, but Scott says if you're just starting a business or have an idea you'd like to try, using Google's data can feel like a straitjacket.
Google Maps are licensed to you for a very specific purpose. You're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. If you just want to use data, there are all kinds of restrictions about what you can do with them.
And Google charges customers that use large amounts of mapping data. OpenStreetMap is different. It uses grassroots mapping, so it's open source, meaning it has few licensing restrictions. And it's completely free, even for companies using a lot of data.
So a lot of sites did start moving to OpenStreetMap.
Martin Garner, an analyst with CCS Insight, says companies like Apple and other Google competitors realize maps are becoming key to our digital lives, from choosing a restaurant to finding the nearest dentist. But it's more than that. Tech companies are developing the so-called Internet of Things. They want your possessions to be able to communicate with each other. Say your car could talk directly to your front door lock.
If we have an Internet of Things, then it becomes very important to know where those things are.
So maps are going to get more important and more detailed. To boost the level of sophistication, Garner says you can't simply rely on volunteers. You need professionals.
So this is one of our cars.
In a town just outside London, Mark Williams climbs out of one of those Google-like camera cars I mentioned earlier.
We've got 4 cameras, 16.2 megapixel cameras.
But Williams does not work for Google. Instead, this car belongs to Nokia. Yes, the company that made your clunky old cell phone before the smartphone was invented. Nokia has sold off its ailing phone business and is now counting on its mapping service for at least part of its growth. Michael Halber heads Nokia's mapping division called HERE, spelled H-E-R-E. It is hardly a household name, but Halber says HERE's maps are used by many of Google's biggest competitors, like Microsoft, Yahoo, and Amazon, and HERE has made a big push into the automotive industry.
4 out of 5 cars today with an embedded navigation system run on our maps.
Inside Nokia's camera car, Mark Williams says the company uses a laser scanning technology to generate a realistic 3D image of all the trees, buildings, and everything else the car passes.
Visually, the renderings of the buildings look like imagery that you would associate in computer games.
And Martin Garner of CCS Insight says that could lead to far more detailed maps than we've ever had before.
Not just maps of the streets, but maps of what's on the third floor of this mall or what's on the 10th floor of that building.
Garner says Nokia adopted 3D mapping before Google, but he says Google is catching up on the technology.
There's a sort of race going on between these guys, and so they're pouring a lot of money into this task to build it up as quickly as possible.
Of course, we would have asked Google about all of this, but it did not respond to an interview request. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Wirth in London.
2 weeks ago, just in time for summer, we asked you to tell us about your attempts at digital detox, putting down the smartphone, avoiding email, staying off social media, taking a tech vacation. There are studies about this kind of thing, and it's harder than it sounds.
A clear majority can't do it.
That's Susan Muller, professor of media at the University of Maryland. She has asked thousands of college students to unplug for a whole day, and not just from phone or TV.
That means music, that means newspapers, you name it, they can't consume it.
Many students who participate say it's one of the toughest things they've ever done.
It's everything from, I was totally desperate, I panicked, I felt so lonely, I felt incomplete, my senses went numb and I felt paralyzed, the silence was killing me.
Susan Muller says when college students give up media for a day, they speak about it as though they were giving up an addiction. But she says there's value in that.
It's just like being reminded that, yes, we need oxygen, and that sometimes if you take a deep breath, yeah, there is life out there.
Well, now to your experiences. We've heard from hundreds of you and your tales of tech-free vacations. Heather Bowman of Portland, Oregon, tells us she spent a week unplugged with her husband in a remote area of Washington State, and she writes this, "The one moment I really wanted to connect was when we felt an earthquake." And she adds, pulling the plug was definitely easier when it wasn't self-discipline, but simply no choice. For Tasha Wallace of Morrisville, Vermont, the choice is simple. She writes, "Your tech vacation story ran during soccer's World Cup, and on this year's vacation, I have never been happier to be wired. I like checking the scores or the highlight reels while watching loons on the lake." And she concludes, "Take all the tech vacations you want. I'm going to be plugged in until the final goal." That's goals, spelled there with four O's and four A's. We also asked some of you to record your responses on a smartphone, naturally. Jeff Johnson of Ewing, New Jersey, spent his vacation in a cabin without TV or internet.
And so each day at lunch, we went into town, and I found myself surreptitiously scanning email messages during, quote-unquote, bathroom breaks at the local cafe.
Finally, Telly Adlam of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, tells us that she found a very simple solution for hard digital detox.
I locked my iPhone in a safe for 24 hours, and it worked.
Well, thanks to everyone who wrote in. You can tell us about your tech vacation using technology on Facebook and Twitter. We are at NPRATC.